And then I want to talk about how we know whether what we're thinking is correct. It's an interesting question. Excuse me. It's an interesting question. And there's a really great sutta. I suspect some of you might have even heard me talk about this before. This is called the Kalama Sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya. And it's basically the Kalamas, the village or group of people that the Buddha was talking to. And this is what the Kalamas have to say. The Kalamas, who were inhabitants of Kesaputa, sitting on one side, said to the Blessed One, "There are some monks and Brahmins, Venerable Sir, who visit Kesaputa. They expound and explain only their own doctrines. The doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Some other monks and Brahmins, too, Venerable Sir, come to Kesaputa. They also expound and explain only their own doctrines. The doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Venerable Sir, there is doubt, there is uncertainty in us concerning them. Which of these revered monks and Brahmins spoke the truth and which falsehood? Venerable Sir, there is doubt, there is uncertainty in us concerning them." Sort of describes the reason, part of the reason I want to do this particular teaching is it really describes what's going on in the world right now so clearly. It's not Brahmins anymore, it's like politicians and different people, and everybody's got their own particular axe to grind. And they're all saying that they've got the correct answer and everybody else is wrong. And how do we know what to believe? How do we know which one is right? It's a question we're all struggling with, I think, if we start to seriously think about what's going on in the world. The Buddha, of course, has this great answer. This is the Buddha's answer. What I want to do is sort of take this answer apart, but it's just one rather pithy paragraph, his answer. "Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, 'The monk is our teacher.' Kalamas, when you yourselves know, these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, enter on and abide in them." There's that word abide. Make these things your the home for your heart. And really what this whole sutta is about is right view. Because it's our views and opinions are what cause us to create our own suffering and the suffering of others. And we come to our views and opinions through exactly what the Buddha is talking about here. This is how we form our views and opinions, and then clinging to them, sticking to them, we act and speak in ways that are unwholesome. So let's take this apart. So the first there, he had 10 things, 10 things he shouldn't do. First one was acquired by repeated hearing. You hear something often enough, you start to go, "Well, of course, that's everybody's saying that, right?" And we start to hear it and hear it and hear it, and it becomes the truth. This is how politicians get people to believe what they want them to believe. They just keep saying it over and over again. But it's not just politicians. I just read a rather quite a disturbing article in the New Yorker, actually, that sort of fits right in with this. I've been a New Yorker magazine subscriber for like 47 years or something like that. Like my very first, my wife and I got together, my first birthday, that's what she got me for my birthday, was a subscription to the New Yorker magazine. So maybe I have my own biases based on the views of the New Yorker, which I have to be aware of. But this article was about the people, the women who had come forward during the Me Too movement back, 7, 8 years ago, which is still going on to a certain extent. But they were talking about how basically these women who initially, when they came out, there was articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and there were all kinds of praise for them for being so strong and wonderful what they did. But what happened to these women? After all the foo-foo-rah, and this was particularly about, there was a guy named Roy Moore who was running for, at one point, the Alabama Supreme Court, and then he was running to be a senator from Alabama, and actually didn't get defeated because these women, several women, came out quite strongly and accused him of sexual assault and sexual shenanigans. And so at the time, everybody's going, "Yay, yay, these women are so wonderful." And then afterwards, a year afterwards, 2 years afterwards, he charged them all with defamation of character and slandered them. And they then countersued. But he had all this money and very rich backers, and he could hire public relations firms to stimulate having the same thing said over and over and over again. And it became the truth that these women had were liars. That's what the truth became. They actually lost, in some cases, the defamation suits against this guy. It's only because someone kept saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. And because these people were rich, they could hire people to do that for them, to stimulate the saying it over and over and over and over. And we see this all over the place, not just, this is just an article that struck me as how this is so endemic to our culture. And so it's like, if we let these things that we hear that are acquired by repeated hearing form our views, we're often essentially have been led astray. And we have to be aware of that. So this is something to be mindful of. Just because we heard it over and over and over doesn't mean anything other than someone's getting really good at saying things over and over and over and getting other people to say the same thing. Sad to say. And so that's a little, sorry if I got on my hobby horse a little bit there, but this article really upset me, bothered me. This is what just rich men could just destroy these women's lives, which is what has happened over and over and over again. So the second one of this is tradition. And this is like, well, how often do we say, well, it's always been that way? It's always been that way. That doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it anything other than that's how people have got into the habit of being or saying and doing something. It's always been this way. It's so easy to get caught there too. It's like, oh, it's like the family tradition, or it's the tradition of my culture. And so my view is based on that tradition that it's just something that's been going on for a while. It's sort of like the first one, only it's tradition gives it an extra gloss of like official seriousness, right? Rumor. Third one. Yeah. This is like, well, I heard it someplace. This is if the internet had been around back in the Buddha's day, he would have, this would be have been, I saw it on the internet. The internet, wonderful thing that it is, and it's very useful, and it's a great tool, you know, and all that, but it's incredibly misused, and all kinds of stuff is, goes out onto the internet, and people go, well, it's on the internet. You know, it's like I've had conversations with people. You know, when I worked as a carpenter, I used to have these conversations with these guys who were, let's just say, from a different culture than I was part of. And they would say stuff, and I'd go, well, why do you think that? And they said, well, I saw it on this place, this blog, blah, 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 some place on the internet. And because it agreed with how they thought, it became the truth. It's like, this is how things become true, air quotes, right? Just because someone starts a rumor and people believe it because it sort of connects with their belief system of how things are. And we have, this is just another thing we have to be aware of, that it's so easy to, because we think things are, should be a certain way or are a certain way, and then we hear something that reinforces our ideas. We then go, of course that's true. It's right. It's got to be right. But it isn't. It's just a rumor. Fourth one, scripture. You know, it says right here in the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, in the Pali Canon. Says right here, this is how it is, right? Therefore, must be true. It's in the holy book. But holy books are just things that were written down by people who wanted to support their view. That sounds a little harsh, I realize, but it's true. It's like people, you know, every holy book you ever read is being is a compilation of views that people who wanted to support their particular belief system wrote down so that other people would think these were the absolute truth. And it's true, I mentioned the Pali Canon there just because, you know, there's a place in the, I found this place in the Pali Canon. This is forget exactly where I got it written down someplace. I won't chapter, quote chapter and verse. But there's a place in the Pali Canon that says quite distinctly that women aren't capable of becoming fully realized. Only men. And so women have to come back in another life as a man, then they can get fully realized. And this is in the Pali Canon. And I talked to my teacher about this one time, a long time ago, after I discovered this. I was like, what the heck is this book? And he said, well, you know, the Pali Canon got written down 200 years after the Buddha passed. And already the patriarchal trust structures of the society, which, you know, 2,500 years ago, 2,300 years ago in North India was a pretty patriarchal place, believe me, had already started to creep in. And people started shifting the Buddhist teachings just in little ways here and there to satisfy their beliefs. And this is true of, pick your holy book, you know, it's true of any of them. These are things that got written down and became the truth. And there's, I'm not saying there is an incredible amount of beauty and truth and wonderfulness in all of these scriptures. I at one point read pretty much the entire Bible and was amazed at how much great stuff is in there. It's an amazing book. But it's also got a lot of stuff that's like, what? If you start pointing to certain verses in the Bible, it's like, well, it's okay. Slavery is okay. It's like, wait. But it's like back there 3,000 years ago when that particular part of the Bible was happening, that's what everyone believed. And it just never got, it didn't get cleaned up as time went on. So scripture is important. I don't know what I'd do without the Pali Canon as a guide for how I practice and teach. But don't believe everything you read in the scripture as being the right thing. Because there's things in there that, things get shifted and adjusted and interpreted. And then there's the whole aspect of translation. Well, the Pali Canon was originally written in Pali, of course. And then it sort of got translated into Sanskrit, and got translated into other things, and then eventually it got translated into English, which is what I'm reading. I'm not a Pali scholar. Well, things that ha so when things get translated, the biases of the translator also get embedded in the translation. My wife is a Sanskrit scholar, and she'll still be looking at some teaching that's in Sanskrit, and she'll have be there be like five different interpretations of the same set of verses based on who did the translation. And this is just like normal. The Bible I was first familiar with, the King James Version of the Bible, well, it had this is like 400 years ago, by a group of scholars who were very traditional British English gentlemen. How many biases are they going to put in there? I don't know, but it's like you see where I'm going. Okay, sure. So those that's just another place you just have to be aware. Look at the scriptures, appreciate them, be amazed by them, but don't assume for one second that everything that you find there is right. Because it's not. Then next one is, then it comes through to a whole series of like ways we mentally process things. First one is surmise. And I actually, some of these I had to look up in the dictionary to find, because these are subtle differences, right? So surmise, the definition of surmise is to think or infer without certain or strong evidence, a conjecture or guess. Gee, we're gonna believe, but because we, it's our surmise, it must be right. That's what happens. We surmise something, and then we solidify around it because we've told someone and they thought it was a good idea too, and all of a sudden it's the truth. But there's no strong evidence, it's just a conjecture or a guess. Similarly, there's an axiom. You studied math like I did, you came across mathematical axioms all the time, but this is more like in the world of words. And an axiom, here's once again the definition based on under the dictionary. A self-evident truth that requires no proof or is a universally accepted principle or rule. A self-evident truth, I mean, duh, how can you not see this, right? That requires no proof or a universally accepted principle or rule. I underlined in my notes here, universally accepted. Because what that really means is universally accepted by people like me. But there's like lots of different versions of universally accepted. depending on culture and depending on nationality and depending on social status and all kinds of different things, you get different versions of what's, quote, universally accepted. But it's my version of universally accepted, and so of course it's true. Everybody knows this. That's one you have to, when it comes to right view, yet that's one thing you have to really watch for is when you hear this little voice in your mind going, well, everybody knows that. Well, actually, it's everybody you know. Everybody like you knows that. But it has nothing to do with everybody at all. Just doesn't. This is number 7 on the list of 10. Specious reasoning. Once I had to look this one up too. Right? Apparently good or right, though lacking real merit, superficially pleasing are possible. Keyword that I underline superficially pleasing. Once again, it's like, I like that one. You hear something and it's stated as a truth, and it's like, feels right. It has a good vibe, right? And we like it. And because we like it, it becomes things we base our actions and thoughts and speech based on this thing. But the reason we do that is because we like it. It's pleasing to us. But it doesn't mean it's right. Just what's pleasing to us might be totally not pleasing to someone else, for instance. So it doesn't make it the truth at all. It's just the pleasant version of the truth that I'm sticking with for now, which is a very different thing. Then there's this one. I like this one. A bias towards a notion that is being pondered over. Ah, I'm smart. I thought about this a lot, I pondered over it, and I figured it out. So it must be true. This is conceit. And we have to watch this one too, because, we all like to think we can figure things out. We all know that we thought somehow we've, because I'm so smart, I can figure out the answer. But it's just that answer is affected by all of my biases that I don't even see as I ponder over it often, if I'm not careful. And so we have to be very careful about this one because I'm smart, I know what I'm doing, I've got this figured out. That's where we go. And then end up believing something that's may have some modicum of truth and understanding, but isn't the absolute truth in any sense of the word. Then we have the next one. Another's seeming ability. So you feel like the idea is coming from a person you should believe, because they seem to know what they're talking about. You're listening to someone and having conversation with someone, and this person just seems like, well, this person really got it together. This woman just knows what she's saying. She really understands. So it's got it. Makes if she, and they present it in such a powerful way that it's like, well, it's got to be true. Just this person's really good at talking. And we have to remember that there are people who are really good speakers and who can just dot all the I's and cross all the T's as they explain something. And it just seems that they really know what they're talking about, so therefore it must be true. It's just what this person has figured out. It's just what they've pondered over and then they've turned it into something they can explain. They're skilled at that. That's all. Then the last one, I love this one. This person is your teacher. You've taken this person as your teacher, so you should believe what they say is true to be true. You need to be obedient to the teacher. And this in our culture, in the spiritual culture, is a really dangerous place. You know, in the extreme, it's like you drink the Kool-Aid, right? But there's lots of ways of drinking the Kool-Aid without actually killing yourself. But you see this all the time in groups of people who form around a particular person who becomes their teacher. And then the cult, I use that word intentionally, the cult around, based on what that teacher says or had said or says again and again, becomes the truth. And not only that, you have to obey the teacher and be a good student by obeying the teacher. I was part of an organization like this back in my 30s and 40s, which I eventually wisely left. And I'm also, I want to make it really clear, there's a great many things about organizations like this that can be quite wholesome and wonderful. That's why I learned to meditate originally. Was within this, but as time went on, I started to see more and more of the cultish nature of things, where you either believe this was the truth because the teacher said it, or you were wrong. End of discussion. I just ended up questioning things and people who I knew, had known for a long time, but this was their, they had really invested in believing what the teacher said. And if you didn't believe it, you were wrong. End of this, I was like, that was how, that ended discussions. This is what the teacher said. Teacher was just a fallible human being, just like you and me. He wasn't in any way an enlightened soul. And even then, who knows? And it's like, what I find so interesting about this is the Buddha. The Buddha is basically saying to the Kalamas, after he goes through all this long list of all these other things, he says, "And don't believe anything I'm saying." An interesting thing for the Buddha to say, right? "Don't believe anything I'm saying." Oh, that's an interesting thought. And then, after he says that, he says, "And what to believe? When you yourselves know, these things are good. These things are not blamable." The key word here is yourself. So it's not because someone told you these are good. It's not telling someone that told you this is the right way. It's you, at some level, feel, yeah, this is true. This resonates, this makes sense. At some intuitive level, you know this to be true. And it's true partly because you've experienced what the teacher is saying or the teaching is saying. It's like, do this and then, and this is what will happen, and see how this, how what this is. Sure enough, that's what happens, and you, it becomes like, oh, yeah, this actually makes sense because it's something I know on an experiential level. It isn't intellectual anymore. It's lost. I might have got to that place where I had that experience from an intellectual process, but it's experiential knowledge has a different quality to it. And this is why this practice is called insight meditation. You've had an insight, and it just that insight makes it very clear. But that's one of three things it has to be, okay? Not just that. Just that all by itself, we might get into trouble falling into one of these other things, like something I pondered over, it makes sense. When you yourselves know these things are good and these things are not blameable, then he says, these things are praised by the wise. So the wise, in the sense of the Buddha's teachings, the wise were that group of monks who he hung out with, essentially, who hung out with him, who had also become enlightened. And so people respected what they had to say because they, like the Buddha, were enlightened beings. Because you often get in these guys, the Buddha was always sending these guys away. It's like, go, they'd get together for 3 months to practice together, and then he'd sent them off in pairs and send them all over Southeast Asia. Go, get out of here, go teach. So the wise could be, one of the Buddha's primary disciples. Because he didn't want them to hang around all the time. But he would also want. So it's we don't have that luxury of hanging out with direct disciples of the Buddha, direct students of the Buddha. So, but is this so? Does this make sense? But also, this is where, are there people you consider to be wiser than you when it comes to the teachings? What do they say? Go talk to them and ask them about. Well, this is what happened, this is what I experienced, this is what makes sense to me, but what do you think? So get some input from others that are, quote, further along the path. I hate to use that term, but it's like I can't think of any other. Who you respect as having some degree of wisdom when it comes to the teachings. So there's that. These things are good, they're not blamable, the wise say so too. And then, the final step, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. It doesn't lead to happiness. Wait a second. Benefit and happiness. Do you feel? Not only do you have this clear insight, not only is this insight supported by the teachings and by the other people who are wise, but it leads to your benefit. Do you feel your life getting better, clearer, calmer, more full of loving kindness? And does it increase your own happiness? Then, this is something you can believe is right. It has to have all three of those things. It has to be insight, it has to be connection to others who understand and can explain, help you out, grok how it happened. And then, in the longer term, does this lead to a place where you feel, yeah, this actually makes my life better and brings more happiness into my life and the life of others. Now I can take this in and go, yeah, this is okay. This seems right. Understanding, of course, that you have to be willing to give it up completely if later on you discover something you have deeper insight and you go, oh, well, that was sort of okay, but, can't cling. This is a view you've adopted, but don't cling to it. Even though this seems like a great, holy, wonderful view, don't cling to even that. You have to be able to let it go. If that's what becomes clear to you some further along time. It's sometimes the hardest part. You thought you thought something was true. It was perhaps even at the time, it was true for you and it was a benefit to you. But then you let it go because no longer. It was like the simile of the raft where the Buddha talks about. Once you get to the other shore, you don't carry the raft around with you, the raft being whatever, the skillful means you use to get across the flood. You let all that skillful means go. Shove the raft off into the water and let it float away. You can't cling to anything, even the teachings. And the other thing this thing says is, and this is important, I think, you put these ideas, whatever this insight was, you put this thing to the test of your own practice. Nothing to do with what anybody else says, nothing to do with what you read in a book, nothing with what the teacher said. You practice based on this understanding, and it worked. It connected at some very deep level. There's this clear insight that brings benefit. It's wholesome and brings benefit. Then we know it's right. But the main thing is it leads to happiness, I think. I mean, if this practice doesn't, I mean, there's going to be times this practice makes you miserable and drives you crazy. I'll guarantee that. But overall, in the longer term, if this practice doesn't lead you to happiness, think about how you're practicing. Because there's something missing there. The Buddha was called the happy one for a reason. This practice led to his own happiness. So that's the Kalama Sutta. I just love this teaching because it makes it so clear all the different ways we can sort of fall off the edge down some rabbit hole that we get caught in for a while. Hopefully we can crawl back out of the rabbit hole. It's all these, this is like a list of all the things we have to watch our mind doing. And go, oh, it's that one now. Now I'm getting caught that way. It's fascinating to watch your mind go through all these various versions of how we make things right, things we have to believe in, things that must be correct. I think a lot of what this practice is about, as we go a little deeper into the practice, is about exactly that. There's this famous saying of I think it's one of the Zen patriarchs, but I'm not even sure. The saying goes something like, don't seek enlightenment, just cease to cherish views. This is how we create views that we cherish. Exactly how we create views that we cherish. That we've got it figured out. So, anyhow, this is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence, and it's called Mysteries. Yes. Great title. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a home. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. I think that's really great advice about who you want to hang out with. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. Sounds good to me.